It is my pleasant duty this afternoon to call the college together for the formal opening of the academic year. Convocation is one of the few times in the year when we join as a community to acknowledge our common purpose, education in the liberal arts, and our common values. Although all experience, in some sense, educates, the liberal arts differ because they place at their center the content of humane learning and the spirit of systematic, disinterested inquiry. The ultimate subject of the matter is humanity itself, the worlds, the creative works, and the acts of human beings. The liberal arts seek to understand the worlds we inhabit and have created, the worlds of art and of thought, and our social and physical worlds. The liberal arts assume a continuity of human endeavor, and therefore of learning in the present, about, and from the past. Convocation is not only an expression of this fellowship of teachers and learners, but this particular convocation offers an opportunity for all of us to have a glimpse of the creation and to share in the execution of two exquisite products of the human imagination, an opera and a novel. Chester Biscardi and Alan Gerganis will share with us the difficulties and triumphs of keeping a long work alive, an opera and a novel. Chet Biscardi has degrees from the University of Wisconsin and from Yale. Alan Gerganis is an alumnus of Sarah Lawrence and a celebrated graduate of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. Of course, one of the tasks involved in keeping a long work alive is to keep the composer and the author alive. And to this end, Chet has received a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Ives Scholarship from the American Academy and the Institute of Arts and Letters, grants from the National Endowment of the Arts and the Martha Baird Rockefeller Fund. Alan has been kept alive by grants from the Danforth Foundation, the National Endowment of the Arts, the Ingram Merrill Foundation, and some others. Each has won a significant prize and been nurtured and sustained by residents in communities whose purpose it is to enable the creative person to work productively, the American Academy in Rome, and YADO. And we trust that each has been encouraged and sustained by their colleagues and students at Sarah Lawrence.
At some point in my personal journal, I wrote, "The process of working out a life, personally and artistically, is what my life is all about. Although it now strikes me as being a bit pretentious, I do feel, on the other hand, that it is valid. In fact, the other day while talking to a young man in the public relations office here at the college, I made that exact statement. At the end of the conversation, I begged him not to have the director return my call because, as usual, I was unplugging my phone to go back to work. He said, "Well, have fun working on life." What more really can you wish to anyone, not just to the creative artist? And by the way, everyone has the same flashes of inspiration, moments of understanding, and perceptions of beauty that we usually assign only to the quote-unquote artist. If the artist is singular at all, his only singularity is that he hangs on to and is fascinated by those moments of revelation and inspiration that most people look at and let go. The artist notices those moments of insight earlier, pays more attention to them, and spends more time questioning them. But he pays a price for that insight. Many people think that the artist is driven by his inspiration along a single, uncluttered path toward the completion of his work. In my experience, that is far from the truth. That straight path to accomplishment is cluttered with many roadblocks, the most disturbing of which is the inevitable self-doubt. I found some words of playwright David Robb that said it for me perfectly. He says, "Much of the early struggle in writing is with what I call the censor, the voice that says it's not good, or wants to know what the third line will be before you've written the first one. That voice is very, very untalented, and when I really get going, it just vanishes." If I had the notion that that sense of doubt would disappear the longer I work as a composer, I had a rude awakening when I began my opera, Tightrope. Suddenly, I had to deal with two elements that were quite strange to me. I had to deal with the words, and I had to deal with the stubbornness and contrariness of characters. Up to that time, my creative vocabulary had been all the elements of musical structure. As for the perversity of characters, Alan, of course, is very used to that, as I am used to the musical scale. I was warned that they would move into my studio, try to dictate their own music, flatly refuse to sing mine, and I didn't believe it. I was wrong. Characters take away your freedom to sit and compose as your imagination carries you. They do take over, and that is precisely what keeps the work alive, however many years it may take, because you have no way of predicting in a tidy fashion how characters choose to explain themselves. It reminded me of a remark of Simenon, the French mystery writer, who said in his memoirs, "I put myself into a state of grace before beginning a novel," and when asked to explain it, said, "The Catholic idea, the state of grace, the idea of being without sin." I didn't believe in that. I did believe in a sort of vacuum, to be completely receptive, to become empty so that the characters may inhabit me. I become the characters. I am a slave of my characters, but not of myself. Or as Charles Dickens puts it, I put my fictitious companions in the upper place at feasts. What brought those words of Simenon and Dickens to my mind was receiving a phone call inviting me to accept a commission for a new chamber opera to be premiered 2 years later at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. If I accepted the commission, and after much hemming and hawing and soul searching, I did, then I was going to have to deal with living characters in a music drama. Tightrope is a chamber opera in one act, 9 uninterrupted scenes. The libretto is an original idea by Henry Butler. The story is as follows. The legend of Luther Dane, a poet and cult hero, enhanced by his mysterious disappearance and presumed death, is now the subject of a film biography. On the first day of shooting, work is disrupted when the actor portraying Dane angrily insists that his lines could not be the words of the man whose life and poetry he so admires. Left alone to sort out his feelings, the actor is suddenly face to face with Luther Dane, very much alive, an unsuspected witness to the filming. Intrigued by the actor's concern for integrity in his portrayal, the poet offers to piece together the not so well-known story of his life and presumed death. Through Dane's memories and actual encounters, the actor experiences the poet's explosive career, the men and women who shaped his life, and his powerful influence when he spoke to his dedicated followers. Most important, the actor learns the truth about Dane's escape from an unbearable public image. When the poet abruptly takes leave of him, the actor begins to find the words and images he must use if he is to portray with honesty the life of Luther Dane. I realized that I had to be every one of the characters, hear his or her music, and find out how it could possibly work with everyone else's music. Fine, so I understand that. So where do I begin? Do I begin with musical themes, which some of my fellow composers insist is the only way? Do I begin with individual arias, that is to say, songs, for each character? Or do I begin with abstract expressions of the entire theme of the opera? The fact is, to some extent, I ended up doing all three, and I never knew for sure which one was going to come first. For instance, from my personal journal, Thursday, June 7th, 1984, I was at the McDowell Colony with the librettist. My entry was, "I finished a first sketch after a week of the poet's aria, I did not intend to be a poet. I played it for Henry. He said, 'It's somber, don't you think? The line has a narrow range, it's confined.' And here I thought it was too Broadway, too naive, and too open sounding." Needless to say, I was depressed. I felt that I didn't have the talent for characterization or to write something as big as an opera. Of course, that was pure self-pity. But I was scared. I had been working intensely, and I wanted some relief. The last thing I said to myself in that entry was, "I need to go on now. I am defining my version of this, and at this moment, this is the best I can do." The next morning, I sounded a little more sensible. This is always how it works. I'm depressed at night, I feel better in the morning. There is no alternative to doing music. It may provoke fear and anxiety, but any other life would be dull and irresponsible. Some things will need to be scratched. Sometimes I will have to start all over. This morning it is very clear. The poet is not reflective. He is simply describing how he felt when he was young. After the first version of the aria and several others, I finally listened to what the poet wanted to say. This is the opening of the aria.
I did not intend to be a poet. No one, no one does. The title has no meaning, and the profession less. Day after day, the words and pictures made me drunk, tumbling through my head, demanding that I give them order. And that order is called poetry.
He goes on to speak of his youth, and this is the way he and I recaptured the sense, the feel of being young. First, I found a voice to comfort me as no one could. I found an ear that heard me, no matter how corrupt or frightened I might be. And most wonderful, I found a way to praise the utter beauty of everything I saw, the faces, the colors of the air, everything that grows and reaches for the sun, the miracles of what the heart can feel, the very fact that we are alive at all. Oh, I was young. That too was miraculous, and silence was impossible. I wrote my praise and sang it in the streets.
I found a voice to comfort me as no one could. I found an ear that heard me, no matter how corrupt or frightened I might be. And most wonderful, I found a way to praise the utter beauty of everything I saw. The faces, the colors of the air, everything that grows and reaches for the sun. Was miraculous, and silence was impossible. I wrote my praise and sang it in the spring.
The voice you are hearing is that of baritone John Reardon, who created the role at the premiere. And in subsequent scenes, I found that what I had to do was listen to the poet and listen to my inner voice, since very simply, I had experienced every emotional change that he was going through. And not surprisingly, I had to do exactly the same thing with the principal female character, Catherine. The librettist had given me some hints. Here's the note from my journal. She is a mature woman, has a natural flamboyance, gypsy blood, more exactly black Irish, Celtic mother and a father who's a Spanish sailor, independent, dresses as she pleases, can wear anything, it will become the fashion. She might have been burned as a witch in earlier days. Men notice her. Women often resent her. Warm, expansive. As she says of herself, I love easily. Now, what is a composer supposed to do about a woman like that? We had agreed that when the audience first saw Catherine, she would be creating a song. Did I mention that she is a musician and a composer? based on a text of the poet Luther Dane. In fact, I received the text of 7 possible songs from Henry. The first one went like this: Lady, by your grave demeanor, I perceive a heart that grieves. What brings you into the market, bartering with priests and thieves? And this is what I heard. 5 notes and a chord. Catherine never did sing those words, but she gave me approval for the 5 notes and the chord, and accepted my idea that her song would develop into a trio involving the poet and the actor who are eavesdropping on her creation of the song. She sings, I love the wanton freedom of my life to gratify my deepest appetite and seek the joyous company of men to taste the rich variety of men. I love to watch the sensuous parade of shameless beauty as they strut and preen in blissful nakedness, so plumage proud, poor flightless creatures, still so plumage proud. I love their strong, blunt fingers on my skin, the sudden heat of harsh and broken breath, the unexpected rush of tenderness, that awkward, sweet, surprising tenderness. I love them all, not one do I regret, for all too soon I will not feel their touch, but then I will be resting in my grave, remembering and smiling in my grave.
Then I will be resting in my grave.
The voices you are hearing are those of soprano Audria Firestone, John Reardon, and tenor Marcus Haddock. I could and would, with very little encouragement, show you how the same birth and evolution of the nine characters in the opera, but that would mean performing the entire work for you, and I would much rather that you meet those characters in the theater supported by a full orchestra. I hope that what I've shared with you answers the question of how a composer, well, how I, at least, can keep a long work alive. Incidentally, the mixture of confusion, inspiration, and commitment does not, alas, end with the first performance of the opera. I expect to be haunted for a long time by passages in Tightrope where the inner voice says, "No, I should have done it in a different way." The only way to silence that voice temporarily is to get on with the next piece of work. Thank you. I don't think we know what we're doing now, so you can help us out. This was the open dialogue format where we were going to respond to each other's work habits and whatever. Maybe since there are so few minutes, is that a question? Is that a question?
I have something to say in relation to your work. Is this not on?
Is it on? Pull it closer.
Okay. I have a feeling that students sometimes have a notion that when you decide to become a writer, dispensations are granted from on high, and that the fear of the typewriter stops, that the kind of dread that one feels when one faces writing a thesis or a paper is somehow magically overcome. It does not necessarily always get easier. What comes to your rescue is something we call obsession, something we call tremendous commitment and desire, and a sense that however bad you are at this, you're not really any better fitted for anything else in the world. So I think part of career decision is narrowing the field to that particular territory where you feel you have the most flexibility and strength and staying there and getting better. And I was very touched at Chet's apartment when we were talking about what we're going to do today, to see the mass of tapes and manuscript pages and notes that constituted a block from the floor almost this size that was his opera and that is his opera and that's the documentary of how it was created and how it was made. I think it's easy in our zeal for the finished product to overlook and underestimate how much sheer stupid persistence is involved in getting a thing done. And if that is a message that you go away with today into the year, I think it would be a worthwhile one.
Unfortunately, it seems that most of the energy, at least I find that I use, is with that, dealing with those issues of how do I, from moment to moment, exist without freaking out with the largeness of a project like an opera. And it was interesting, 2 days ago, one of my former composition students here called me and said, "I'm very excited. I've been given a commission to write a song for a major motion picture. I got this commission 6 weeks ago. I've put no notes down. I got 2 weeks left. I'm never going to be a doer. What can I do?" And I said, "Well, I think the first thing you must do is to let go of that part of the project which says I'm a large motion picture and I'm going to eat you alive. I'm either going to make you very famous or you will never ever write another note for the rest of your life. I'll make sure of that." You have to, I mean, anything which takes a lot of development and usually a lot of time, you can't look at the whole thing. I did that a lot with the opera. Up to the last day of orchestrating, which was of September 13th a year ago, they were already in rehearsal. And I used to hear about opera composers like writing the page and, you know, the ink would be wet, and they, well, that happened. And I didn't want that to happen. But along the way, I kept thinking, how am I going to finish this thing? I mean, I've got to write the opera first, and then I've got to orchestrate the opera, and then I've got to argue with the directors and scene designers and all of that. But it all took its time, and it happened. And my advice to this composer was, get rid of that. Sit down and do what you do best, which is to write music. If when you sit down, no notes come, get up, have a peanut butter sandwich, get up, take a walk around the city, get up by yourself. Ann Patchett, who was here a few years ago, a writer and who was one of my Donnies, used to laugh at me because I would always buy tulips. And she bought tulips, so we shared something. I would go out and buy tulips. I had so many tulips in my house one time I couldn't breathe. But it's better to do that than to say, I can't write today, therefore I'm a rotten composer, therefore I should sell shoes, which I say every other week. I don't know what else to say, but you have to sort of get rid of the fear of the large project and simply do what you do. I mean, if you're successful, fine. If you're not, fine. That's not what it's really about. It's the commitment to the work and the discipline to the work. Just one other thing, and I guess I had this down on something I wanted to say in the body of the speech, but I'll say it now. That is that no one held an axe over my head and said, Chet, you must be a composer. At some point, I chose that. And choosing that, I choose the responsibilities that go along with that. The responsibilities of frustration, the responsibilities of being in the public arena and presenting my work, and having people both say, I love it, and that is the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. And dealing with those issues. And the fact is, no one else can write my music except me. And I guess I say that because, in a way, that's very much part of the ideal of Sarah Lawrence, in the larger sense that the independence of the work here really rests on you, and whether it's a creative project or whether it's a paper for chemistry, it has to do with you really coming through with the work. Is that a question? I ultimately could not have chosen that. I actually started out in pre-law and English literature and dropped music completely. I wrote when I was a kid and I stopped because my family wanted me to be a lawyer or something like that. And I went through that. And then I came back via Italian literature. I sort of snuck in the back door. I thought I'd do literature at least. And then I came to the point where I just had to write music again.
Well, you couldn't help but write music.
Well, apparently not. My experience is I'm here doing that.
I started out to be a painter, and I always thought of myself in that regard from being a little kid. I always assume, because my father told me so often, that I would also have to do something else, because I would die, starve, shrivel in the world, being totally unable to support myself. One of my great pleasures in life is being able to say to my father, it's really not so hard. Just kills him. It kills him. But I think this question of career that Chet raises is an interesting one. I mean, part of the delight of being at Sarah Lawrence is being so near New York. And that's also part of the jeopardy of being at Sarah Lawrence, in the sense that sometimes the notion of career gets in the way of learning what it is that you want to pursue as a career. Some idea of heightened facility, some idea of having lunch with the right people, and that somehow magically doors will open. Finally, one of the things that I'm doing is trying to tell stories in such a way that they will sell. It sounds crass and commercial, but my hope is that if a story is true and that if it speaks to enough people in a clear and deep enough way, that it will be presented. And I think that given the fact that you have, and I had when I was a student here, the luxury of years of time to sit alone in your room and to have available to you people who care passionately about what they're doing, forget lunches in New York with editors and with agents, and there will be time for that when you have something that you feel absolutely identified with, something that is synonymous with everything that you consider valuable and pure about yourself. don't get the mercantile aspects in the way of what you should be perfecting and clarifying here, which is what you have to say and what you want to tell and what feels best to you.